And we have both counsel on video. Can you hear us okay?
Yes. Good morning, Your
Honor.
Yes,
Your Honor.
Should I begin?
Yes, whenever you're ready.
All right. Good morning, Your Honors. This is Ina Lipkin on behalf of the petitioner. The case is before the court, I believe, to determine the issue of the petitioner's well-founded fear of persecution and feasibility of relocation. The immigration judge, or IJ, did ultimately find the petitioner credible, but as we argue, opined erroneously that he did not establish that the members of the ruling parties in the Punjab...
Can I ask you about that? You said that he found him credible. That's not entirely true. It's sort of a partial credibility determination, because he found some of the testimony incredible, implausible.
He determined that that overall the testimony was credible, and then he outlined, I believe, 2 points of concern that he deemed implausible. But for a cogent credibility finding, it can't be wishy-washy. It's either credible or not credible. And he did not make an adverse credibility finding, and thus the board had to adopt that decision, and it did under the matter of Burbano case. And thus, this court has to find the petitioner's testimony to be credible. Again, there was no cogent adverse credibility finding.
Well, he says it, this is at AR-51, despite the fact that a portion of his testimony is implausible, the court, and despite the fact that there's 2 or 3 inconsistencies, the court does find that overall his testimony is not substantially incredible. Like, I'm not entirely sure what that means. Like, it doesn't say he's credible.
But there is no articulated adverse credibility finding, and under the BIA case law, failure to state an adverse credibility finding must be deemed to be a credible finding.
Well, okay, so let's go back. So if you go back a page at AR-50, he says, the part that is implausible in this case is that the respondent then continued on to state that after he went into hiding and then left and went to the United States, members of the Congress Party then went to his house and asked about him. Why isn't that an adverse credibility? I mean, he specifically says that that's implausible.
Well, on the one hand, we attacked that finding in the opening brief and down below before the board, because the IJ failed to provide any evidence in the record to substantiate that opinion. It's purely based on speculation and conjecture. There's nothing inherently implausible by that claim, given that the petitioner had credibly testified regarding 2 attacks, the last one by the Congress Party members. It is just as plausible to assume that he was known in the village by these people, and therefore they would know where he lives.
So could I interrupt you? It seems like there are some things that the IJ didn't believe, it seems. One of these is the attack afterward. It seems like part of it was the weapons that he was attacked with in the first attack. There are certain things that the IJ says, I don't really believe these are plausible. It seems like you want to argue with that, but let's just take that as given. Do you need those pieces of his testimony to support the pieces of your claim?
If you're asking, did the petitioner establish he was beaten by members of the BJP on January the 5th?
Like, whether or not it was hockey sticks, if he was beaten, is it enough? We don't need it to be hockey sticks, right? So it seems like you may be able to go forward with your argument with the pieces the IJ did believe.
Yes, Your Honor. And that is especially true in light of the fact that he sustained grievous injuries requiring medical treatment. the IJ didn't find that remarkable or implausible, and therefore so that aspect of his claim has to be
removed. I agree with you on that. I agree with you on that. And so where did the IJ find, can you point me in the record where the IJ found that this was done by the Congress party or the PJP party? Because that seems to be where the discrepancy is, because the BIA certainly didn't interpret it that way. I mean, would you agree with that? The BIA interpreted the IJ's opinion to be that this wasn't done by the Congress party or the BJP party.
Well, let me break that apart. So the BIA cited Matter of Bourbon, as I mentioned earlier, and therefore it adapted the entirety of the judge's decision as if it was its own. So putting that aside, I go then to the IJ's decision. And it's a weird decision because on the one hand, he says the testimony's credible despite those two inconsistencies. And then that he established, let me see, one moment. I just wanted to give
you... Let me point you to a couple that... If you go to AR-54, the IJ says, accordingly, the evidence is insufficient to show that these attacks occurred by the government of India or that the government of India agreed with these attacks or perpetuated these attacks or encouraged these attacks.
Okay,
go ahead.
Okay, so I found on AR-53, the IJ expressly says... The petitioner established past harm rising to the requisite level on account of his Mon party membership. And then he goes on to sort of undermine his own finding.
But that's not inconsistent. He could be attacked because of his Mon party membership. The question here is, was it done by a government official or someone that the government wouldn't control?
I think the answer to that question lies in the petitioner's credible testimony that he had approached the police for assistance and protection, and the police rebuffed him. And
well, that's a tough one for you because both the IJ and the BIA rejected that as grounds for the asylum claim. So where is it that the IJ found? Can you point me to a specific AR citation where the IJ said this was the government that was acting, or it was at least a member of the party that was acting?
The IJ did not find that, but his earlier...
Oh.
Wait, why are you saying that? At the top of AR-53, the IJ says that. The IJ says it would further find that the reason, according to the respondent's testimony and other evidence in the record, was that he was beaten by BJP party members and Congress party members on these two separate occasions, and it's because he was a member of the Mon party.
Yes, and I mentioned that at AR-53, that at first the IJ made that finding, and then he worked his way to undermine his own finding. The fact that he found that the petitioner was harmed on account of the Mon party membership leads us to conclude that he was attacked by people opposed to that. His own credible testimony indicated the people who opposed this Mon party membership were members of the BJP, the centrally ruling party to the current time, and the Congress party, that was the former ruling party in the Punjab. The contradiction here lies in the IJ's own determinations, where he had analyzed that the petitioner did establish harm, not just harm because of his Mon party membership. He specifically added to the requisite level, which comes back to your question, Your Honor. Did it matter whether the mention of hockey sticks and baseball bats was to be calculated in the harm he received? Clearly, the immigration judge found that whatever harm by whatever means was used on the petitioner did rise to the requisite level. And again, I think AR-53 is conclusive on that. I might save the last 30 seconds, unless you have a question.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the government.
Good morning, Your Honors. Raya Jarwan on behalf of the U.S. Attorney General. May it please the court, I would first, in discussing credibility, I think what the agency did here was the agency found reluctantly that overall the testimony was credible. However, credibility does not equate to persuasiveness and burden of proof. And I think that's what the immigration judge was really getting at here. Just because you have testimony indicating that two attacks occurred doesn't mean you've persuasively proven that those attacks were committed by individuals who were members of the Congress Party or BJP.
Can you address Judge Friedland's reference at AR-53, where the IJ says it would further find, so the IJ would find that the reason, according to the respondent's testimony and other evidence of record, that he was beaten by BJP party members and Congress party members on those two separate occasions is because he was a member of the Man Party. What, isn't that a finding? Why isn't that enough to say that's a finding by the IJ that he was beaten by members of the BJP party and the Congress party?
The next sentence, I think, is crucial because the context of the whole decision really reflects what the IJ's intent here is. It says the respondent's evidence in this regard is not strong. And then the IJ goes on to describe why the evidence is not strong.
But then the IJ ends, nevertheless, the court would find that although this is a close issue, the respondent has met his burden, that this was on account of his political opinion. I don't understand how the weaknesses in between can be seen to not to totally take away from the sentence before and after the weaknesses. Because the IJ is saying it was because of politics.
I think that goes back to the difference between the nexus portion of this analysis and the past persecution portion. Those are actually two separate analyses. The nexus is obviously, is the conduct committed on account of the Man Party? And as I think Your Honor Judge Nelson said earlier, these individuals could have committed this against him because of his Man Party membership, but the identity and the affiliation of those individuals is still unknown because the IJ says on two different pages that there's no evidence these individuals were willing participants.
Yeah, well, at 54, I wanted to reference that because at 54, the IJ then says there's no evidence that these individuals acted on behalf of the Congress Party or the BJP Party or the government of India. Is that what
you're... Yes, that is exactly what I'm referencing. And throughout the entirety of the IJ decision, the IJ refers to them as individuals, as not willing participants, as unknown vigilante assailants.
Well, how do you comport that with 53? I actually agree with you on the conclusory statement of that first paragraph on 53, that it does only reference the political opinion. But there's this stray sentence that seems inconsistent with the rest of it. What do we do with that?
Go ahead, Your Honor.
Nope.
I think a part of the reason that it is a bit confusing, the IJ makes it clear that he's referencing according to the respondent's testimony and other record evidence. So the IJ is referencing again the fact that the respondent himself seems to believe that these were BJP members and Congress Party members. But the entirety of the IJ decision and the board decision makes it very clear that the agency's intent is not to ascribe these individuals with automatic opposing party membership. The board says they are alleged private persecutors, unknown private individuals, references the phrase private individuals.
Right. The board says that, but the board can't make its own credibility determinations, right? So the board can only say that if it's interpreting the IJ correctly, and it's not clear it was.
I think that based on the entirety of the IJ's decision, it was, because the IJ makes it very clear with the relocation analysis that if you are unable to demonstrate past persecution, it is incumbent on the applicant, the asylum applicant, to then demonstrate whether he can safely whether it be unsafe or unreasonable to relocate.
But the IJ said he did meet his burden regarding past persecution.
Well, that was the alternative analysis. Even if he met past persecution, the IJ then said DHS properly rebutted by preponderance of the evidence the presumption of a well-founded fear of persecution based on the individualized analysis of Singh's personal circumstances as well as the country conditions evidence.
But wasn't so the relocation, wouldn't that have been a mistake under Carr and Whitaker if he actually was beaten up by party members who were part of the whose parties were part of the government?
And can I add something here? Because is it possible that since his decision came down before Carr, that he's doing a two-part analysis? In other words, that he's determining that it was a party problem. But he says, however, the court will find, after he says, you know, that although this is a close issue, the respondent has met his burden, that this was on account of his political opinion, he also says, the affidavits submitted on the respondent's behalf also state that these individuals threatened the respondent, told him to join their party, and the court will find that he has met his burden regarding this prong of past persecution. But his next sentence says, however, the court will find that the respondent has not met his burden to show that that these actions were done by the government or someone the government is either unwilling or unable to control. So is it possible that this analysis was done prior to Carr and that he's doing a two-prong approach here?
This analysis was done prior to Carr, and the fatal flaw with Kaur is that the agency never made a determination specifically as to government-sponsored conduct. The petitioner made an argument in that case that it was government-sponsored. The agency pretty much ignored it. It didn't do a thorough analysis. We don't have that flaw here. Even though the IJ's decision was pre-Kaur, the board does cite to Kaur in its decision as a CF citation in order to distinguish the fact that in this particular case, the agency did conduct an analysis of the government conduct or non-government conduct, whereas in Kaur that was not done and there was a remand as a result of that. And also in regards to the Singh case, the Singh case, I believe, had an issue with the individualized analysis for relocation, which again, we don't have that flaw here, where we have a specific analysis with regards to all the country reports and Singh's young age health and education and his ability to relocate to 8 different states outside of Punjab that have plenty of Sikhs living there safely and reasonably. So
sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but I did have I wanted to sort of bring it back to Judge Friedland's question, which is she asked about the BIA not being able to make specific findings of fact, which is I assume the government agrees with that. The BIA cannot make those. Is there a standard of review? Say that we were to find that the IJ's factual findings were ambiguous. Is there any deference that we would owe to the BIA's interpretation of the IJ's factual findings? Or do we look at that de novo? Or is that, I don't know that we have a case on this, by the way. I mean, I don't want to ask an impossible question. I wasn't able to find anything, any scenario that was similar.
I'm not entirely sure, Your Honor. I mean, I think the point here, though, is that the agency wasn't ambiguous, and the board seems to wholeheartedly agree with that. I mean, the standard for this court, obviously, is the substantial evidence standard, and the court has to look at all the record evidence to see if it compels reversal of the agency's finding. And given the lengthy decision by the immigration judge really hammering home that we don't have enough evidence of government conduct, and the board agreeing with that in multiple locations in its decision, I would argue that it's not ambiguous. And the Supreme Court in the Garland versus Ming Dai case explained that credibility alone is not dispositive of persuasiveness and legal sufficiency. And
if
I think that's really—
Let me just to put a finer point on it. If we don't agree with you that it's unambiguous, would you agree that we need to remand it for clarification?
So if the factual findings...
We think that the IJ was inconsistent. Do we need to say, hey, look, this could be interpreted this way, this could be interpreted the other way. We don't know. You need to tell us what you really were doing. Or can we defer to the BIA's interpretation of potentially inconsistent statements by the IJ? I mean, obviously you win if we find that the IJ was unambiguous in finding that the Man Party. My question is that middle ground. If we can't come to a conclusion there, what do we do? Is there a way that you still win, or do we need to remand?
I would say, Your Honor, even if there is some ambiguity with regard to that part of the analysis, you still have the relocation analysis. And that is a significant portion of the decision, because the immigration judge goes through a significant number of reports. So this is not although unable and unwilling is a dispositive analysis generally, there is a reason the regulations also provide this other portion of the analysis, because even if this individual has demonstrated past persecution, DHS has the opportunity to rebut the well-founded fear presumption.
Can I ask about that, though? So if he was attacked by party members who were part of the ruling party of the government, then under Carr and Singh v. Whitaker, wouldn't he be entitled to a presumption that that's the government throughout the country and he can't relocate? And where is the presumption in this analysis that the agency did?
I don't believe that in the board's decision, and I believe also in the agency's, in the IJ's decision, the board in the footnote number one says, nor did the immigration judge err in concluding in the alternative that DHS had rebutted any presumption of a well-founded fear, citing to the regulation, which also includes that presumption of reasonableness that Your Honor is referencing. But again, that presumption is not concrete. It can still be rebutted. And the evidence indicates that Singh he was a low-level man worker. He had no leadership role in the party. He did not have a criminal record. And he spoke Punjabi, and he would be able to relocate just like the millions of others Punjabis had relocated outside of, or Sikhs had relocated outside of Punjab. So again, just because that presumption is present in the regulations does not mean that it's concrete or a per se final outcome. So again, I understand the ambiguity in the IJ's decision on certain sentences, but I think overall the context of the agency decision is quite clear in this case. And I see I'm over my time, so I apologize, Your Honors, but I'm willing to answer any further
questions.
Thank you
for answering our questions. Other questions?
No.
Okay, we took the government over time, so let's give you a minute for rebuttal. I think it's a little more than you had.
Yes, Your Honors. So I just feel AR-53 is dispositive to establish that the IJ overall determined that the petitioner was credible and was harmed on account of his Man Party membership. And he says at the top of that page, it would further find that the reason, according to the respondent's testimony and other evidence of record, that he was beaten by BJP members and Congress Party members because he was a member of the Man Party. And then he ends that paragraph with, nevertheless, the court would find that although it's a close issue, the respondent has met his burden, that this was on account of his political opinion. So to parse out the other sentence in which he says, well, there wasn't a lot of proof that it was Congress and BJP party members, was refuted by his own reasoning that the only reason petitioner was harmed was on account of his political opinion. And those were the two political parties that harmed him. Thank you.
Thank you, both sides, for the helpful arguments. This case is submitted.